You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts, RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 99 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 Lectures, translated by Johanna Collis, entitled Rosicrucian Wisdom. This is Lecture 12, given in Munich on the 4th of June, 1907. Entitled The Evolution of Humanity on the Earth, Part 2. The process that I have described to you as the division of the sexes was of such a nature that the two sexes are to be thought of as still united in that animal-human of Moon, and also in its descendants in the Moon recapitulation of Earth. After this, a kind of division of the human body really did take place. This division came about through a kind of densification. Not until a mineral kingdom had been separated out, as it is today, could the present human body arise, representing a single sex. The earth and the human body first had to be solidified to the mineral nature as we know it. In the soft human bodies of Moon and the first period of Earth, human beings were of dual sex, male and female. We must remind ourselves that in a certain respect the human being has preserved a residue of this ancient dual sex, since in the present man the physical body is male and the ether body female, while in the woman this is reversed. The female physical body today has a masculine ether body. These facts open up an interesting insight into the soul life of the sexes, the capacity for sacrifice in the service of love, displayed by the woman, is connected with the masculinity of her ether body, whereas ambition in the man is explained when we realize the female nature of his ether body. I have already said that separation into the human sexes arose from the intermingling of the forces sent to us from the sun and moon. In this connection, you must understand that in the man, the stronger influence on the ether body emanates from the moon, and the stronger influence on the physical body from the sun. In the woman, the opposite is the case. Her physical body is influenced by forces of the moon, and her ether body by those of the sun. The continual exchange of mineral substances in the human being's present body could not come about until the mineral realm had taken shape. Before that, there was quite a different form of nourishment. During Earth's sun period, all plants were full of milky juices. Human beings were nourished by imbibing the milky juices from the plants, as today the child draws nourishment from its mother. The plants, which still contain milky juices, are the last stragglers from the time when all plants supplied these juices in abundance. It was not until a later time that nourishment took on its present form. To understand the significance of the separation of the sexes, we must be clear that upon Moon, and during its recapitulation on the Earth, all the beings looked very much alike. Just as a cow has much the same appearance as her descendants and all other cows, since the group soul is in the background, so could human beings scarcely be distinguished from their forefathers. And this continued until well into the Atlantean age. Why is it that human beings no longer resemble each other? It comes from the establishment of the two sexes. From the original androgynous nature, the tendency has continued in the female to produce similarity in the descendants. In the male, the influence worked differently. It tended to call forth variety, individualization. And with the flowing of the male force into the female, dissimilarity was increasingly created. Thus it was through the male influence that the power of developing individuality came about. The ancient dual sex had yet another peculiarity. If you had asked one of the old dwellers on Moon about his experiences, he would have described them as identical with those of his earliest ancestors. Everything lived on through the generations. The gradual rise of a consciousness that only extends from birth to death came about through the individualizing of the human race, and at the same time arose the possibility of birth and death as we know them today. Those ancient moon beings with their floating, swimming motion were suspended from the environment to which they sent the strings conducting their blood. Thus, if a being died, it was not a death of the soul. It was only a dying off of a sort of limb, while the consciousness remained above. It was as if your hand, for instance, were to wither on your body and a new hand grow in its place. Thus, these human beings, with their dim consciousness, experienced dying merely as a gradual withering of their bodies. These bodies dried up, and new ones continually sprouted out. Consciousness, however, was preserved through the consciousness of the group soul, so that a kind of immortality really existed. Then the present blood came into being, created in the human body itself. And this went hand in hand with the arrival of the two sexes. With this, a remarkable process became necessary. The blood creates a continuous conflict between life and death. A being that forms red blood within itself becomes the scene of a perpetual struggle, for red blood is continually used up and changed into blue blood, into the substance of death. Together with the human being's individual transformation of the blood, arose that darkening of consciousness beyond birth and death. Now, for the first time, with the lighting up of the present consciousness, the human being lost the ancient, dimly sensed immortality, so that the impossibility of looking beyond birth and death is intimately connected with the division of the sexes. Something else, too, is connected with this. When the human being still possessed a group soul, existence went on from generation to generation, with no interruption being caused through birth and death. Then this interruption appeared, and with it the possibility of reincarnation. Earlier, the son was merely a direct continuation of the father of the grandfather. Consciousness did not break off. Now there came a time when consciousness was dimmed beyond birth and death, and a sojourn in Kamaloka and Devakan first became possible. This interchange, this sojourn in higher worlds, could only come about at all after the individualization, after the expulsion of sun and moon. Only then did incarnation, as we call it, come about. And at the same time, this intermediate state, which will one day also come to an end again. We've reached the period at which the earlier androgynous organism, representing a kind of group soul, divided into a male and a female in such a way that the similar is reproduced through the female and the varied and dissimilar through the male. We see in our stage of evolution female as the principle which still preserves the old conditions of folk and race, and the male, that which continually breaks through these conditions, splits them up, and so individualizes humanity. There is at work in the human being an ancient female principle as group soul, and a new male principle as an individualizing element. Eventually, all connections of race and family stock will cease to exist. Human beings will become more and more different from one another. Interrelationship will no longer depend on the common blood, but only on what binds soul to soul. That is the course of human evolution. In the first Atlantean races, there still existed a strong bond of union, and the first sub-races grouped themselves according to their coloring. We still have this group soul element in the races of different color. These differences will increasingly disappear as the individualizing element gains the upper hand. A time will come when there will no longer be races of different color. The difference between the races will have disappeared. But on the other hand, there will be the greatest differences between individuals. The further we go back into ancient times, the more we meet with the prevalence of the racial element. The truly individualizing principle only began as a whole in later Atlantean times. Among the earlier Atlanteans, members of one race actually experienced a deep antipathy for members of another, whereas common blood caused a feeling of connection, of love. It was considered improper to marry a member of another stock. If, as a seer, you were to examine the connections between the ether body and the physical body in the old Atlanteans, you would make a remarkable discovery. Whereas in the human being of today, the etheric head virtually coincides with the physical part of the head and only protrudes slightly beyond it, in the old Atlantean, the etheric head projected well beyond the physical head. In particular, it protruded strongly in the region of the forehead. Think of a point in the physical brain in the place between the eyebrows, but about a centimeter lower, and a second point in the etheric head corresponding to this. In the Atlanteans, these two points were still far apart, and evolution consisted precisely in the fact that they gradually came closer together. In the fifth Atlantean period, the point in the etheric head moved into the physical brain, and by reason of these two points coming together, there developed what we possess today, calculation, counting, the capacity to judge, the power of forming ideas in general, intelligence. Formerly, the Atlanteans had only an immensely developed memory, but as yet no logical intellect. Here we have the point at which the ego began to grow conscious. A self-reliant independence did not exist in the Atlanteans before these two points coincided. On the other hand, they were able to live in a much more intimate contact with nature. Their dwellings were constructed out of what was given by nature. They molded the stones and bound them together with the growing trees. Their dwellings were formed out of living nature, were really transformed natural objects. They lived in little tribes that were still preserved through blood relationship, whilst a powerful authority was exercised by the strongest, who was the chieftain. Everything depended on authority, which was exercised, however, in a way peculiar to those times. When human beings entered the Atlantean age, they could not yet utter articulate speech. This was only developed during that period. A chieftain could not have given commands in speech. But on the other hand, these human beings had the faculty of understanding the language of nature. Present-day human beings have no idea of this. They have to learn it anew. Imagine, for instance, a spring of water which reflects your image to you. As a spiritual researcher, a peculiar feeling emerges in your soul. You say, "My image comes toward me out of this spring. To me this is a last token of how on old Saturn everything was reflected out into space." The memory of Saturn arises in the researcher when he sees his reflection in the spring. Likewise, in the echo, which gives back the spoken sound, there arises the recollection of how on Saturn all that resounded into cosmic space came back as an echo. Or you see a Fata Morgana, a mirage in the air, in which the air seems to have taken up whatever pictures are imprinted in it, and then reflects them again. As a spiritual researcher, you see here a memory of the sun period, when the gaseous sun took in all that came to it from cosmic space, worked it over, and then let it stream back, giving it its own sun nature at the same time. On the sun planet, you would have seen how things were prepared as a Fata Morgana, a kind of mirage within the gases of the sun incarnation. In this way, without being a magician, one learns to grasp the world from many aspects, and that is an important means toward developing to higher worlds. In ancient times, human beings understood nature to a higher degree. There is a great difference between living in an atmosphere like the present, or one such as that in Atlantis. The air then was saturated with immense vapor masses. Sun and moon were surrounded by a gigantic rainbow halo. There was a time when the mist masses were so dense that no eye, EYE, could have seen the stars, when sun and moon were still darkened. Only gradually did they become visible to human beings. This coming into sight of sun, moon, and stars is magnificently described in records of the creation. What is described there really did take place, and much more besides. The Atlanteans still had a strong understanding of their natural environment. All that sounds in the rippling of the spring, in the windy storm, and is an inarticulate sound to you today, was heard by the Atlanteans as speech they could understand. There were at that time no commandments, but the Spirit pierced through the vapor-drenched air and spoke to the human being. The Bible expresses this in the words, quote, "And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters," close quote. Human beings heard the Spirit from surrounding objects, from sun, moon, and stars. The Spirit spoke to them, and you find in those words in the Bible a plain expression for what took place in their environment. Then came the time in which an especially advanced portion of the human race, who lived in a region which today is on the bed of the ocean, in the neighborhood of present Ireland, first experienced that definite union with the ether body, and thus an increase of intelligence. This portion of humanity began to journey eastward under the guidance of those most advanced, while gradually immense volumes of water submerged the continent of Atlantis. The most advanced portion of these people journeyed right into Asia, and there founded the center of those civilizations that we call post-Atlantean culture. From this center civilization radiated out, it proceeded from the groups of people who later moved further to the east. There in Central Asia they founded in India the first of these civilizations, which still had a strong echo of the culture attained in Atlantis. The ancient Indians did not yet have a consciousness like that of today, but the capacity for it arose when those two points of the brain I mentioned coincided. Before this union, there still lived a picture consciousness in the Atlanteans, through which they saw spiritual beings. In a murmuring of the fountain, they not only heard a clear language, but the Undine, who has her embodiment in the water, rose for them out of the spring. In the currents of air, they saw sylphs. In the flickering fire, they saw salamanders. All this they saw, and from it have arisen the myths and legends that have been preserved with most purity in the parts of Europe where there remained remnants of those Atlanteans who did not reach India. The Germanic sagas and myths are the relics of what was still seen by the old Atlanteans within the vapory masses. The rivers, the Rhine, for instance, lived in the consciousness of those old Atlanteans as if the wisdom which was in the mists of ancient Niflheim had precipitated out in their waters. This wisdom seemed to them to be in the rivers. It lived there in the form of Rhine nymphs or similar beings. Here in these regions of Europe lived echoes of Atlantean culture, but over in India another culture arose, one that still showed remembrances of that picture world. That world itself had sunk from sight, but the longing for what was revealed in it lived on in the Indian. While the Atlantean had heard the voice of nature's wisdom, to the Indian there remained a longing for oneness with nature, and thus the character of this old Indian culture is shown in the desire to return to that time when all this was the human being's natural possession. The ancient Indian was a dreamer. To be sure, what we call reality lay spread out all about him, but the world of the senses was Maya in his eyes. What the old Atlantean still saw as hovering spirits was what the Indian sought in his longing for the spiritual content of the world, for Brahma. This kind of going back toward the old dreamlike consciousness of the Atlantean has been preserved in Oriental training as a way of retrieving this early consciousness. Further to the north we have the Medes and Persians, the original Persian civilization. Whereas the Indian culture turns sharply away from reality, the Persian is aware that he must reckon with it. For the first time, the human being appears as a worker, who knows that he has not merely to strive for knowledge with his spiritual forces, but that he has to use them for shaping the earth. At first, the earth met him as a sort of hostile element, which he must overcome, and this opposition was expressed in Ormuzd and Ahriman, a good and an evil divinity, and the conflict between them. People wished more and more to let the spiritual world flow into the terrestrial world, but as yet they could recognize no law, no laws of nature, within the outer world. The old Indian culture had a genuine knowledge of higher worlds, but not based on a knowledge of nature, since everything on the earth was accounted Maya. The Persian learned to know nature purely as a place of work. Then we come to the Chaldean, the Babylonian, and the Egyptian peoples. Here people learned to recognize a law in nature itself. When they looked up to the stars, they sought behind them, not the gods alone, but they examined the laws of the stars. And hence arose that wonderful science which we find among the Chaldeans. The Egyptian priest did not look on the physical as an opposing force, but he incorporated the spiritual, which he found in geometry, into his soil, his land. Outer nature was recognized as conforming to laws. In Chaldean, Babylonian, Egyptian wisdom, external star knowledge was inwardly united with knowledge of the gods who ensoul the stars. That was the third stage of cultural evolution. It was only in the fourth stage of post-Atlantean evolution that human beings advanced to the point of incorporating in civilization what they themselves experienced as spiritual. This is what occurred in the Greco-Latin time. Here, in the works of art, in molded matter, human beings imprinted their own spirit into substance, whether in sculpture or in drama. Here, too, we find the first beginnings of city planning by human beings. These cities differed from those of Egypt in the pre-Grecian age. In Egypt, the priests looked up to the stars and sought their laws, and what took place in the heavens they reproduced in what they built. Thus their towers show the seven-stepped development which human beings first discovered in the heavenly bodies. So too do the pyramids show definite cosmic proportions. We find the transition from priest wisdom to real human wisdom wonderfully expressed in early Roman history by the seven kings of Rome. What are these seven kings? We remember that the original history of Rome leads back to ancient Troy. Troy represents a last result of the ancient priestly communities who organized states according to the laws of the stars. Now came the transition to the fourth stage of culture. Ancient priest wisdom was superseded by human cleverness, represented by the crafty Odysseus. Still more plainly is this shown in a picture which can only be rightly understood in this way, and which represents how the priest wisdom had to give way before the human power of judgment. The serpent can always be taken as a symbol of human wisdom, and the Laocoon group depicts the overthrow of the priestly wisdom of ancient Troy through human cunning and human wisdom symbolized in the serpents. By the directing powers who work through millennia, the events were then outlined that had to happen, and in accordance with which history must take its course. Those who stood at the foundation of Rome had already preordained the sevenfold Roman culture, as written in the Sibylline books. Think it through yourselves. You find in the names of the seven Roman kings reminiscences of the seven principles of the human being. This goes so far, in fact, that the fifth Roman king, the Etruscan, comes from outside. He represents the principle of Manas, spirit self, which links the three lower and the three higher principles. The seven Roman kings represent the seven principles of human nature. Spiritual connections are inscribed in them. Republican Rome was nothing other than human wisdom replacing ancient priestly wisdom. In this way, the fourth age grew out of the third. Human beings sent forth what they had in their soul into the great works of art, into drama and jurisprudence. Formerly, all justice had been derived from the stars. The Romans became a nation of lawgivers, because their human beings created jurisprudence according to their own requirements. We ourselves live in the fifth period. How does the meaning of overall evolution come to expression in it? The old authority has vanished. Human beings become more and more dependent on their own inner nature. Their external acts increasingly bear the stamp of their own character. Racial ties lose their hold. People become more and more individualized. This is the kernel of the religion which says, "He who does not forsake father and mother, brothers and sisters, cannot be my disciple." This means that all love which is founded on natural ties alone must come to an end. Human beings must approach one another, and soul find soul. We have the task of drawing down still further on to the physical plane what flowed from the soul in Greco-Latin times. In this way, human beings sink deeper and deeper into materiality. Whilst the Greeks in their works of art created an idealized image of their soul life and poured it into the human form, whilst the Romans, with their jurisprudence, created something that still further signified personal requirements, our age culminates in machines that are an entirely materialistic expression of mere personal human needs. Humanity has descended further and further away from heaven, and in this fifth period has arrived at the deepest point, where it is now most strongly ensnared in matter. Whilst the Greeks and their creations raise the human being above himself in their images, for Zeus represents the human being raised above himself, whilst you still find in Roman jurisprudence something of the human being that goes beyond himself, for the Roman placed more value on being a Roman citizen than on being a person and an individual, in our period you find people who utilize spirit for the satisfaction of their material needs. For what purpose is served by all machines, steamships, railways, all complicated inventions? The ancient Chaldean was accustomed to satisfy his need for food in the simplest way. Today, an immense city of wisdom, crystallized human wisdom, is expended on the quenching of hunger and thirst. We must not deceive ourselves about this. The wisdom that is so employed has descended below itself, right into matter. All that human beings had earlier drawn down from the spiritual realms had to descend below itself in order to be able to mount upward again. And with this, our age has received its mission. Whilst in human beings of an earlier time, there flowed the blood which bound them to their tribe. Today, the love which still flowed in the earlier blood is becoming more and more fragmented. A love of a spiritual kind must take its place, and then we can ascend again to spiritual realms. There is good reason for us to have come down from spiritual heights, for the human being must go through this descent in order to find the way up to spirituality out of his own strength. It is the mission of spiritual science to show humanity this upward path. We have followed the course of humanity as far as the time in which we ourselves are. We must now show how it will evolve further, and how one who passes through an initiation can even today anticipate a specific stage of humanity on its further path of knowledge and wisdom. The end of Lecture 12.